Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversation Season 8. Now, before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Shwepnekulu, the ancestral unceded and actually stolen lands of the Shkwepnik people. Every day it becomes clear that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, today our guest in the studio is in charge of a unique eating establishment, unique not just in this community, but in the entire province. David Colomb is the new owner-manager since June of this year of Still Food Bistro and Cappuccino Bar, the only vegan bistro not only in the Shuswap, but also along the entire Trans-Canada Highway between Calgary and Vancouver, or Vancouver and Calgary, if you're going the other way. David, who has a wealth of culinary experience and is also an accomplished musician, is going to share with us the joys and challenges of running a small food business in the post-pandemic world. So a warm welcome to you, David, to Food Conversations.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me and thanks for having me on the show.
We're delighted to have you here. Now, listeners may be aware of the fact that Tyson Still, the originator of Still Food Bistro, has headed off to Penticton to start up a new iteration of the Still Food chain, which is so far two links, which he first established here in 2022. Now, David took over in June of this year, which is only 3 months ago, bringing his own special touch to the bistro located on Alexander Street directly across from the Salmar Classic. Now, this wasn't your first, this is first business ownership, but your first Supremo chef experience was also in Salmon Arm as well at the Podolan.
Very correct, yes.
Table 24. So you've embedded yourself quickly into the matrix of the food world in Salmon Arm. Now, the Voice of the Shoe Shop has just completed a project where we interviewed businesses in Salmon Arm's downtown core to find out what life was like for small business owners these days. What we learned was that small local businesses bring a special perspective to what they do as locally embedded enterprises with roots in the community. We also discovered that the pandemic created significant challenges for many of these businesses, as did a major construction project, the Ross Street Underpass, which rerouted traffic through the downtown core for many months. These challenges occurred side by side with a growing understanding of the importance of local food production, already underlined several years ago when atmospheric rivers washed out all of BC's main north-south highways, cutting out food deliveries from the lower mainland and almost overnight creating empty shelves in the retail food businesses throughout the Shuswap. Over the last decade or two, the growing, harvesting, and distribution of fresh, healthy local food has been expanding steadily. Now, with the many environmental challenges we all face, particularly the climate crisis, rampant pollution, and the overconsumption of natural resources, there's a new urgency to building up local food reserves. And one part of that necessary transformation is the promotion of plant-based eating, which much research has shown to be beneficial for both human health and health of the planet. Now, David, I know when we talked earlier, this is something that really is close to your heart, this notion of local, healthy, when possible, organic food. Was that sort of an evolutionary process in your thinking? It was certainly in mine. Nobody started out, 50, 60, in my case, a few more years than that, thinking about the health associated with food. But now it's really important.
It was an evolutionary process for sure because, food in particular is one of those subjects where when you think you know something, there's 10 more layers to learn at least, right? So, you think at one point in time you're eating a vegetable, it's healthy, but then you realize how far it's traveled or what's been sprayed on it and things like that can make a huge difference to the health of the food and the health of the environment in which the food is being grown.
Now, Still Food, because it's a bistro, it's an eating establishment where everything comes from plants, is unique in that way. I remember when I was invited by a friend to go there and have lunch with her, and on the menu I saw Eggs Benny. I thought, hey, well, what's going on here? This is supposed to be a vegetarian vegan restaurant. And many of the foods have components that mimic animal-based ingredients. It's not necessary, though. There's lots of stuff. I mean, you can just give a brief rundown of the menu for listeners, but there's a ton of stuff that's just really, really nice salads and wraps and stuff that maybe there's a little bit of something that, you know, a sort of vegan cheese or something, but it's really whole range.
Yeah, there's, you're correct. There is a wide range of vegan possibilities. And one of the nice things about, you know, the plant-based meats, if we'll call it that, you know, a lot of people, if they're maybe new to veganism or want to invite a friend, they might want that crossover piece, right? You know, oh, I really
it's nostalgia.
I want a chicken Caesar wrap. And you know, I mean, we do have that, right? Of course, it's not animal-based chicken. It is, you know, a plant-based chicken, but it does gap that, that crossover. Or, you know, if you have in the past eaten meat, the nostalgia you're talking about, there's you have that as well. And some of the things, like you mentioned the egg, it's a really creative way of doing that. So we have an eggs Benny on the menu, and it's all plant-based. Even our hollandaise sauce is plant-based. I can't give away the trade secrets, but it's delicious.
Trade secret will be shared on this program. You also do gluten-free. Of course, I was, you know, these items on the menu, and GF, okay, I got to know this. Good food. No, it can't be that. Then I realized it's gluten-free. And I was surprised how many foods were gluten-free.
Right.
So is that been a kind of an initiative that Tyson sort of brought in or to sort of augment?
Well, I don't know the inception of that, of how much... that was a factor when Tyson brought those menu items up front, but it's definitely a huge factor in what we sell. We're finding a lot of people are having that gluten intolerance, and whether it is truly the gluten intolerance or, you know, other factors in the way that the wheat is being grown, still yet to be seen.
For sure.
But the gluten-free has definitely been an important part, and we have a lot of it, and people are looking for it, for sure.
And coffees. Good Lord, I had to scroll down the coffee menu. It went on for about 3 pages. That's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it's our in-house proprietary brand, Sandbox, and it's amazing and delicious, and it's really, you know, and it's unique because a lot of people use a super dark, maybe almost on the bitter side of coffee for their espresso, and ours isn't quite roasted that dark. It's more of a medium dark, so even just a straight espresso is still really nice and smooth and delicious and very palatable. The coffee's lovely.
Now, I also noticed one thing that I was quite surprised by. You're open 7 days a week
currently. Yes.
Well, currently sounds like a good term, because that's a lot of days to be open.
It's a lot of days to be open, and we'll touch more on this later. It is a challenge, but one of the challenges that I was trying to offset was, open inconsistencies. To try and have people be aware that we're there and have people come on a regular basis. I was really trying to be open 7 days a week. I hope to be able to continue that. It's posing a bit of a challenge.
Well, the challenge right now is it's the season change.
Correct.
And that's a huge challenge for every business, especially food businesses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel your pain, because we heard it from all sorts of businesses here, food and otherwise, that when the summer's over and the great influx of, you know, the orange horde or whatever, yellow horde, whatever comes from Alberta, you know, it really is a change. It's kind of like Christmas for manufactured goods. You know, that's when people buy all their electronics and stuff.
Right.
And the seasonality, we will talk about that more, because it is such a factor. Mm-hmm. And I, as soon as I saw it 7 days a week, I said, that's a challenge right there in and of itself.
Right.
Now, you did one of the pivots that everybody has in their lives in 2008. That's when you went from what was a sort of fairly lengthy career in music to plunge into the food world. And you did plunge in.
I did.
That's when you came to Kelowna, Mm-hmm. And you engaged yourself in the community. You took an advanced culinary degree.
Correct.
Now explain what that's all about.
This degree was unique. I'm not sure if it's offered anymore in Kelowna, but it was really unique because it offered the core culinary certificate that you can still get at Okanagan College or various other.
Is that the colleges. Red Seal thing?
It's part of the program. Of it. Okay. So it's one aspect of the training. The Red Seal program is 3 years, and that's that culinary school section is your first part. Hmm. Then you go off to work, and then you come back for some 6 weeks of classes, and then you go back off to work, and you come back for more classes. And it's a process. The Advanced Culinary Certificate Diploma Program had business courses involved with it. So you had accounting, and you had marketing, and you know all those other sorts of things where they were hoping to launch not only chefs, but business owners.
You know, you also did a bachelor's degree in music business.
Yes.
So you got a little business savvy up the yin-yang.
But, you know, even though I've got both of those degrees, business keeps changing. Mm. And you'd mentioned post-pandemic, and now we're in a world where a lot of that business stuff, I wouldn't say it's you know, not valid anymore, but we're in such a different business environment that you can't settle on your laurels of, you know, what I learned in business in 1994. Sorry, I just dated myself real bad. But
I could go back even further. It'll make you feel better.
it's way different. So you have to keep, you know, morphing with the times
it seems to me that's the nature of business and especially small entrepreneurial enterprises. Mm-hmm. You are following the patterns of society. If society starts to go off the deep end in some area and there's a possibility of making some kind of money out of that, then businesses often go in directions that they don't particularly want to go. What you've done and what Still Food is all about and the way you approach it is bringing values, mm-hmm. bringing important human values to the business setting, which in a way can also be value transposed from one business enterprise to the next, but you have to adapt to the community's values, the community's priorities too. Yes. That is this sort of constant flux that goes on.
Right.
Now, you worked after you did your training. You worked in all sorts of places. And just to remind people that my guest today is somebody who's very seriously embedded in the food world, and that's David Colomb, who's the owner-manager of Still Food Bistro and Cappuccino Bar. But you've done a lot of other things as well. And starting, I believe, I couldn't forget what you told me. Your first business experience in the food world was washing dishes at age 13.
Correct.
That will teach you that there are other things in the food world that you would really like to be doing besides just washing the dishes. Yeah, yeah. But you worked in lots of different places. Why don't you just run through a couple of them? Because it's interesting to see how much you really did.
Cool. Yeah. I did my apprenticeship training at Rod's Regional Table down in Kelowna while I was still going through the Red Seal program. Received my Red Seal from Chef Rod Butters and learned a lot. It was amazing to work under him. Hard job. It was a very hard job. It was a lot of work, a lot of hours, a lot of stress. But the knowledge that I got out of that has stayed with me this entire time.
What was hard and what made it worthwhile?
It was hard because the chef knew the capability of his cooks and would push the limits. But to the betterment of the cooks, mm-hmm. right? Every cook that came out of there was very highly skilled. Mm. One of the chefs that came out was on, what was the show?
Cooking show on TV.
Top Chef, I believe,
yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Another, Kate, who also is in town, she was on Canada's...
Yeah. We had her in
the baking. The baking one. Yes, correct. That's I don't remember the name of the show offhand. But so, I mean, that's the caliber of cooks that came out of that kitchen, but he would push you to get to that limit.
Were the specific skills? I mean, I've tried to chop carrots so they're all even, and it's a mess. And I almost get a finger once in a while.
That's base skill. That's like day one in that kitchen.
Do you have your own knife?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Of course.
Every 100%. Chef has his own knife. Oh, don't touch it.
Chefs get very upset if you use their knives. in that kitchen specifically, I carry this with me to this day. I was taught how to utilize the local ingredients either now or how to preserve them to use them on the off season. Farmers would come through that back door with stacks and stacks of food. It was almost painful to see, but when raspberries were in season, that's when you get raspberries, and we would get bins and bins and bins of them. So you had to use them, freeze them, dry them, you know, make them into jams, whatever it was, because we knew in a few weeks or a month or whatever that raspberry season was, it's done. Yeah. So if you want raspberries for the winter, you take care of them right now.
Did you have storage facilities? Do restaurants have lots of storage space for stuff like this?
Lots, no. No. Some. We use it very creatively.
On top of that, over there behind the bin, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The freezers were packed. The fridges were packed. You know, it was not much space at all. And that experience very specifically was indirectly what led me to Salmon Arm, because at the Podolin, they specifically told me they wanted a local organic based menu. And I'm like, I'm the guy for that. That's where I'm at here, right? I had tons of control over that menu. I had 29 different suppliers that I would utilize, all local suppliers, whether it was my, you know, carrots and onions at the base level or wines or specialty ingredients. And my menu would change seasonally to fit very similar to the way I was trained at Rod's Regional Table. And it was difficult, but the end result was absolutely amazing.
One of the things you said was, when food is in season, we cheat.
Because, yes.
You know, you take a really good some vegetable that's really good and rich in flavor and fresh, and right off, you know, somebody harvested the morning you serve it.
Yeah.
You don't have to do much to it.
No.
The flavor of the food, especially if it's organic, because there's more of the flavor compounds. They're mostly defense compounds in organic food because the pesticides aren't keeping the bugs away, so the plant has to generate its own defense compounds. Mm-hmm. And they're the flavor compounds. Mm-hmm. So there is so much more flavor in organic or minimally processed food. So I think it's a wonderful way to cheat. If a guy's going to cheat, give really good stuff. Nobody knows.
Yeah, it's almost unfair. I mean, an easy challenge that anyone can do at home is go to the farmer's market right now, get a big, juicy, full ripe tomato, slice into it, put it on a plate, sprinkle a little tiny bit of salt on it, eat it, and then do the exact same thing in February. We'll go to the grocery store, buy one of those tomatoes, slice it, put a little bit of salt on it, and eat it. It's not even close. It's not
had
the
breakfast.
Same.
Be careful. I haven't had breakfast yet. Do you find each restaurant has its own kind of, obviously the head chef has an influence on the kind of culture and the processes within a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Does each one of them have that kind of, I mean, there's some commonalities, but each one is a little different. How would you describe some of the range of ambience in the food producing, you know, the kitchen part of the restaurants and food places?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think one of the places that I worked would exemplify this the most. I was at Sparkling Hill a bunch of years back, and the team that we had at Sparkling Hill was super cool and unique. We were working under Chef Ross Derrick at the time, and we had such unique individuals in the kitchen. Myself, I was a lot of farm-based, I would say like farm rustic sort of style of food. We had one guy on the team that was totally into the molecular gastronomy. We had chef. Yeah, it was great. We had one chef who now owns his own sushi place down in Penticton. His name is Kazunoguchi. And so he was traditionally trained in sushi. And so you take all the name of these,
for it.
Yeah, exactly. You take all of these talents together. And at that time, we had free reign over the menu. We'd only have five dinner items. And the head chef, Chef Ross, would basically say, okay, look through what we have and let's all create the menu for today. So we would create the menu. Maybe it lasted a day, maybe it lasted 2 days until whatever that product was done. And then we'd shift again. And so then we had this opportunity to put the molecular gastronomy on there, little pieces of sushi bits. And, you know, like, it was amazing. So yes, there is that uniqueness that can come to the plate.
You're going to have to tell listeners what molecular gastronomy really means in real life. I know about molecules, I know about gastronomy, but to put them together.
What
does this guy bring?
You use certain compounds, like, and we use a bit of it at Still Food. So you use certain compounds, like specifically, we make our egg yolks out of certain compounds that are, you know, like
the
agar and stuff like that. That comes naturally from, you know, from seaweed. That's from seaweed, correct. And you can make little spheres. So we make the little spheres for our egg yolks out of roasted yellow and red tomatoes. So there's a little bit of molecular gastronomy in our menu. Not a whole lot, just that little bit. And all that does is it just holds it together in a little tiny sphere that looks like an egg yolk. And it's still liquid. So when you poke into it, it still drips like a, you know, like a soft cooked egg. It's really cool.
I'm listening to miracles being created here. One of the things that you talked about when we were talking before and immediately brought forward when I said, what about restaurants that is important to you? And you said, and I'm going to, this is a quote, the delicacy of the HR aspect, which meaning human relationships and interactions within the food production part of a restaurant, a bistro, you know. Talk about that a little bit. I think that's something that is worth exploring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it evolved over the last 10 or 20 years, and I'm glad for it. You know, you see, I mean, you can still see this in shows that, you know, Gordon Ramsay hosts, and I think even
throwing
he's,
things.
Yeah.
Yelling.
And, you know, the person he trained under, Marco Pierre White, they're almost proud of that abuse that they hand out to their to their cooks, right? And it just doesn't go that way anymore. You know, you need to take stock into your employees and value them, and by valuing them and respecting their inputs, and you know, even down to their, you know, emotional well-being, they're going to be better.
They have it, I can assure you.
Totally. And in the past, that wasn't taken into consideration in a lot of places. It was just suck it up and do your work, and you know, and then get out of here, and you cry in your beer afterwards, and.
What kind of effect does that sort of, I mean, it's all very well to say it's part of the culture of the cook site, but what kind of impacts does that have on people? I'm sure from what I know as a physician, it kind of messes with your head and makes things not very happy inside you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you get job satisfaction, then you get retention and you know, if, I mean, it's just common sense, you treat employees or coworkers well, then they're going to be happier. And that's not just kitchens. I had mentioned, you know, some of the things that happened in the kitchen. If they were to happen in a bank scenario, that would be unheard of. And, you know,
someone would be
police
coming
escort.
To bank to rob the bank of its staff, so to take them away to some better place to work.
Yeah. So that culture is changing.
Now, one thing that you've specifically done that is absolutely crystal clear as an honoring of and recognizing the needs of the people working in Still Food is to have no separation between the front of house and the back of the house. Mm-hmm. That means the kitchen and the place where people eat. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't put that in place, but I really super appreciate that has happened, because, you know, you have traditionally front of house staff and you have kitchen staff, and the front of house staff, it's the face of the restaurant, and quite often the kitchen is in the back sweating and swearing and, you know, whatever they're doing back there. And traditionally the servers would get the tips and maybe you know, maybe shuffle a couple of bucks off to the kitchen staff, and you know, then you'd hear the complaints. Oh, the servers. Oh man, I only walked away with $400 today. And meanwhile, the kitchen staff's like, man, I just had a 12-hour shift, and I made a third of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
So now, when it comes to the monetary part, my kitchen staff is able to share a bit more into that tip structure, so they get to make a little bit more money. They also get to bring the plates to the table that they are proud of showing. Look what we did. Look at our food. You know, then they get to be the face of the food that they have cooked. And it really adds that extra layer of satisfaction to that job
post. You know what you're actually doing? You're negating this myth about the trickle-down effect. Trickle-down effect says, yeah, the people over there are making millions, and somehow it'll end up in the pocket of the people who are making nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you're actually doing, which is creating a structure, or there is a structure in still food that makes it so everybody gets a chance. It's not, you know, you make all the money and it'll go to you one day.
Right.
It's like happening right now.
Yeah.
I think it's about time we negated that myth, because it's been around for far too long.
I have a little sticker on my front window, and it's, you know, it's not very big. It's not very out there, but it's just this little skeleton, and it says, I'm a spooky, scary socialist.
well, everybody in Salmon Arm is now forewarned. They'll probably be flocking to your restaurant if this keeps up. Remind listeners again, I'm speaking with David Colomb, who's the owner-manager of Still Food Bistro and Cappuccino Bar. Now, Podolno was your first work in Salmon Arm.
Yes.
And that's also first time you were sort of the head chef. Mm-hmm. What's it like to own a business? It's a whole different shtick. It's... Mm-hmm. If the word scary, which we've already used once, and you're describing your socialist leanings, which I would say a lot of people around here share, what's it like being in that position? It's a whole different thing, because then you're watching, you know, the books and the accountants and the you know, stuff that's going in and stuff that's going out.
Yeah, it's, you know, for me personally, it's been interesting, but, you know, it is different. I mean, for me personally, it's been interesting as to how to discover that role apart from being a chef. You know, chef is still in charge of their area, but in this role. So it was a learning curve for me to discover where I fit into an ownership role. You know, it's a huge learning curve. I've had to navigate the CRA stuff, the bookkeeping stuff, all of that, where, you know, as a head chef, and I just handed my receipts over to somebody else and went, here you go. And now it's me receiving that.
CRA is so wonderful to deal with. They're trying at all turns to make things really, really, really easy for you. That sigh you just heard was David saying, I'm not sure.
It's not easy, and it's not straightforward, and it's difficult to navigate that sort of stuff. And you know, taxes are huge, and seeing those maybe for the first time of what I was paying and stuff was definitely a eye-opening experience, a little bit of a shocker as to how much gets taken. But I mean, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised about that. But, you know, navigating all of those different parts of ownership, incorporating all of that, was very new for me.
Yeah, I think every small business owner, you gain a lot of insight into how things actually work. It's sort of like seeing the nuts and bolts of how things actually work. But at the same time, it's a real world thing. If the money comes in, we're okay. If the money doesn't come in, we're not okay. That's not an easy thing. Now, we talked earlier a little bit about food quality and how important it's been for you from the beginning of your involvement with formal food preparation and distribution. And you've carried that on to your home. You're co-parenting with your former partner, two young girls. Mm-hmm. And when one came on screen last night when we were talking and said her name was Portia, I said, oh, as in Shakespeare. And she said, yeah, it's not the car, the Porsche.
Right.
And Naomi, what has your role as a father with two young girls, kids, done to shape your sense of importance about quality and importance about bringing it, not just in your workplace, but in your own home?
Well, you know, it is tough, because there is always the outside influence of not great food, whether it's from other kids or even just walking around grocery stores. And part of this is I want them to eat nutritious food. I had mentioned to you we have a term called fresh crunch that I put in their lunch.
I wrote it in my notes.
Fresh crunch.
Fresh crunch.
Yeah. So
okay, listeners, fresh crunch. You've never heard it before. You're going to learn now.
They have to have fresh crunch in their lunch, and it's some sort of fruit, vegetable, you know, little cut up something in there. You know, today they went to school with, or it's pro-D, so they went to daycare with 3 fresh crunches. They had apples and cucumbers and grapefruit. so that's important to me, you know, eating those whole fresh foods. And it's multi-layered as well, because so many manufactured products, as we all know, this is no secret, they're loaded with salts and sugars. And now, even beyond that, there's been a bunch of Instagram posts about, you know, processed foods now and back then. You know, I've seen some like Ritz crackers and things where the list of ingredients in Ritz crackers 20 years ago was,
totally different.
7 ingredients, and now it's 23 ingredients. Right. And I think never was it healthy at any point in time, but now there's a lot of those food additives and ingredients that we just don't know what the heck they are and what they do to you.
And then there's the ingredients that aren't even on the label, the pesticide residues,
right,
the organochemical residues of one sort and another.
Right.
Now all grains that are not organic are sprayed with Roundup a couple of weeks. I've mentioned this before in the show because it's something that really troubles me as a physician because I'm seeing changes in people's health. I've been here for 45 years and I've seen some changes in people's health around certain conditions that are now being linked to changes in gut microbiome, which is influencing things like brain function. And it's not just speculation. There's actual top-class research showing that this is happening. And that stuff isn't even on the label. You can't even read it. But the stuff you read on the label, like butylated hydroxyanisole, you know, BHA. Oh, well, sure, of course, that must be good for you.
Right. You know, and as a parent, it's difficult because as a society, we're all now struggling a little bit financially, but more than we have been in the past few years with mass inflation going on. And you see that box of Ritz crackers, and since it's a huge multinational corporation owned by probably PepsiCo and then
Mr. Christie,
R.J. Reynolds on top of that.
Have anybody met Mr. Christie?
I'm sure he's very kind and very concerned about our health. you can buy that box of Ritz crackers or whatever it is for $1.99, but apples are $4 a pound. The apples that get grown here in our backyard, down in the Okanagan, right here, they're $4 a pound. So I need to spend 3-4 times as much money to have something in my children's lunch that I find acceptable. And even then, even though it's an apple, I'm still taking it home, washing it and scrubbing it before I put it in their lunch because of who knows what is on it. It's a very big challenge. And when I am grocery shopping with my children, because they're very active in that as well, they come with me almost every time because I want to feed them food that they want. So I want them to participate in picking it. If they say, "Hey, Daddy, can we have this?" I'll say, what are the ingredients? And now they can read. And if that top ingredient is sugar, they know what that answer is going to be.
Or
it's probably going to be no.
The top ingredient isn't sugar, but the next 4 are a form of sugar disguised by clever linguistics.
Totally. Yeah. And you know, I'm trying to instill that in them, that is not okay in their food.
You know, it's such an interesting difference between, you know, the old children just be seen and not heard approach, which fortunately is dying out. But to have your kids come with you and they see what you see and they see, and then you hear them tell you, you tell them rather, what's in it and why and what's the relevance, and then they inevitably they're going to say, well, if Daddy says it's good, then we'll probably give it, you know, a couple of second glances. But it seems to me that's such an important thing, this food literacy. People are talking about it all the time. Food literacy is something that has almost disappeared. It's coming back, but it's almost disappeared because of this food in packages with pictures on the front saying what's in it, when you open it up, it doesn't look like the food in the picture. And then you read the label and you realize there's a whole bunch of stuff that isn't even mentioned.
Yeah.
I remember Harvest Crunch and looking at the list and there was so much sugar in it.
Yeah.
Actually kind of makes your gums shrivel.
Yeah.
And you know, the picture on the front is oats and a honey pot and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned to you yesterday the granola bar section in a grocery store, right? The granola bars are pawned off as your healthy snack. And there's a wide range of granola bars. I would probably actually include all of them as now being candy bars instead of granola bars.
Somebody did a sugar content of commercial muffins, muffins and orange juice. And there was more sugar in the muffins and orange juice than a cup of coffee and a donut.
Wow. Yeah.
So
we've
discovered, food sciences told us, if you put sugar in anything, even the cardboard packaging in which you have served your food, it gets pretty crazy.
Yeah.
How do Naomi and Portia feel when they go to school? I mean, they go to an environment where they see the other kids and there's all, as you say, there's these pressures all the time. Mm-hmm. Is that sometimes tough for them?
I'm not sure. I do know they don't get enough time to eat at school. And I'm not going to poke fingers because I'm sure there's reasoning behind everything. And this is all done by, you know, PACs and all that sort of stuff. But myself and another parent were very vocal on the time that they had allotted to eat lunch. And at one point in time, the school actually had extended the lunch period by 5 minutes. They now have 20 minutes to eat lunch.
Oh, Lord.
They had 15 minutes. So myself and another parent had noticed that half of their lunches were coming home. And him and I were discussing this. And you know, we would talk to the children and say, hey, do you not like this? And they're like, no, we love the lunch. We just don't have enough time to eat it. I'm like, oh, interesting. So I don't know if they have too much outside influence at school about their lunches.
But if the structure of the school system is such that they have a very short time to eat, it encourages eating fast. Mm-hmm. It encourages eating food that you can get down easily. You don't have to chew a lot. You know, just slips right down. Mm-hmm. It discourages conversation to some degree because you're stuffing your face. You know, you're not actually just sitting there and enjoying.
And those snackies will go first. So if you have you know, I might put two cookies in their lunch, you know, but, and if you were a child and you had 15 minutes to eat, even though you like those cucumbers and slices of apples, if you had 15 minutes to eat and you had to choose, you're going to choose the cookies.
Of course.
I mean, even adults would choose the cookies, right?
They do.
You know, you would eventually get to your cucumbers and go, oh man, I put
those
in my lunch.
Not of course I ever did that. Yeah. No.
So it is challenging on many levels.
Let's pull back a little bit because, like everybody on this show, pretty much, you have an origin story that doesn't automatically lead to running a vegan restaurant in Salmon Arm. Born in Chicago.
Correct.
The third largest city in the U.S. of A. after L.A. and New York.
Is it now? Yeah, it flip-flops between 3 and 5. So
Yeah, well, it's lately it pulled up its socks and gathered a few people in.
Good for you, Chicago. Way to go.
And like all large cities that have a rich history, it's just loaded with all sorts of cultural, iconic, meaningful structures and relationships and that kind of thing. The first skyscraper was built out of the Chicago School of Architecture, and it was done because steel frame buildings meant you could go up as high as you wanted. Mm-hmm. Before that, as long as the walls held, you could go, so 3, 4, 5 stories. Mm-hmm. But if you went higher than that, the whole thing would fall down if you weren't careful. So the first skyscraper was built in Chicago in 1885, and it lasted for 46 years before they actually tore it down, so it was fairly durable.
Yeah.
Plus, it was the hub of the U.S. Railroad system. They all go to Chicago. That's where all the buying and selling went on in the rail yard there. Your dad was a teacher.
Correct.
And he taught at the same school for 30 years.
Yeah.
Now that's something that might even encourage a little wanderlust in his children. Was it like, your dad was pretty supportive of your, of whatever you did.
You know,
how did that help?
It did create a bit of wanderlust in me, but don't get me wrong. He was at the same position for 30 years, but he had some wanderlust too. He had visited 50 separate countries in his travels, which, being a teacher, allowed him to have I moved across country. I moved to Washington. When I was in my rock and roll days, we would have extensive time off and I'd get to go travel and I'd take a quick flight and go over to Seattle and explore the islands and everything. So I moved to Washington and then, you know, shortly after to Canada and have been living here since 2007. And
you were almost living in Canada when you were in Washington. You were just across the bay from
just across the border.
Rock. Yeah. Yeah. In Birch Bay.
Yeah. I lived right across the street from the water slides, which, you know, if you were in the era of going to school down there in the lower mainland, you took your field trip to the water slides.
Now you learned music to some degree on your own. You mm-hmm. practiced and did a lot of playing, mm-hmm. but the course you took was in music business.
Correct.
Was that after you started to say, well, if this goes sideways, I got to know how to manage my money?
There was a bit of realism to that because I had been playing guitar since I was about 12 or 13 years old. My parents were very supportive of that. They bought me my first electric guitar at that point. And then a few years later, they bought me a classical guitar. And I went, as I was going through high school, I would also commute down to the city and go to the conservatory and take some classes down there. I studied classical guitar throughout my university during music business, knowing that I wanted to do music for a living and knowing the chances of actually being successful as a musician are pretty low. I was able to have a very lovely, very fun, very exciting career in music business, being an audio engineer and a stage manager and a production manager and a tour manager and a tech. So I was in-house tech for a concert venue in Chicago called Park West. It was lots of fun.
The skills you had are often in short supply in the music world. Mm-hmm. Simply people, they play an instrument, they do music. Mm-hmm. They go to concerts and play, but in terms of understanding how the whole system works, that's a whole other matter. Mm-hmm. By the way, in case you're thinking we're talking about music only, I'm having as guest in the studio David Colomb, who is the owner-manager of Still Food Bistro and Cappuccino Bar. Did you play a lot of music, or were you mostly doing all the things you just described, which were pretty much running the entire show?
I was playing as well. At the same time, I was in a band. The band's name was Clip, CLIP. We followed sort of the electronica rock sort of genre that was very popular in the early 2000s there. And we went on tour ourselves and we recorded and we were on the radio and we played shows in Chicago and we were living the rock and roll lifestyle. And, back then it was a hard slog because we were literally handing out flyers and CDs on the corner and doing that whole thing that bands did back then. And we didn't have the advantage, I don't know if it's advantage, but the advantage of so many online programs. Back in the day, that was still we were on GarageBand.com. And
you mean for distributing
for distributing music? Yeah. So we were literally physically handing it out.
Has that world changed with the introduction of various kinds of distribution through the internet?
Oh yeah, I mean I'm not in that sector of the music anymore, but it's totally different. And I think to the musician's advantage,
you can distribute yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And make money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, not going to say you're going to make a ton of money, but if you monetize on Spotify and YouTube and stuff like that, you can make a bit of money. Whereas, back then we only made money if, 100 people showed up to our show.
Right. And agreed to pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, one of the questions I was thinking of asking you was the difference between the culture of food and the culture of music. They're different mm-hmm. worlds, but they have some overlap, and you've got a degree in both.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could maybe speak to that, how they're structured. They're structured mm-hmm. differently.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I think there's a lot of crossover with how you monetize that, right? Everybody's just so in tune with social media and stuff these days. I think that's definitely an important element. Mm. it's easy, it's cheap, it's, you know, can be free if you'd like. And I mean, we are getting a bit deaf and blind to all the advertisements that are floating around. And there is a bit of oversaturation, but you know, it's also important. I, in addition to all of this other stuff, I still do repair and build guitars on whenever I get a minute of free time. But I found that that side of business is definitely, affected, when I do a post or two on Facebook or Instagram about, hey, I have this set of pickups that I just built or whatever. You just need that awareness, right? Mm-hmm. And so that constant awareness. And bands are the same. And that's why you see that repeat stuff. And people, you know, if you're following a group on Instagram, you'll notice, oh, man, they posted that song last week. And now it's just the same song, but a different iteration of that song. But it's just that we have such short-term memory that you need to be reminded all the time of that sort of thing.
When you made the decision to plunge into the world of food, mm-hmm. how did it change the pattern of your life? I mean, food, we've talked about local food, mm-hmm. quality food, seasonality of food, storage of food, distribution of food. It's based on something that comes out of the ground, mm-hmm. if it's plant-based. Mm-hmm. And music, the music profession is the most peripatetic profession in the world. You pick up your guitar and you go to the next town. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that Paul Simon song about, you know, music and my guitar in hand. Every staff is a one man band. But that was, he was a one man band. But even a multi personnel band, you're on the move. I mean, you can even if it's on move between one venue and another in your own community, it's you're never located. You're never mm-hmm. a locational. Mm-hmm. Activity. And food tends to be, and the kind of way you're doing food, which is to have local food and high quality food and fresh food, mm-hmm. is really a little bit hyper local. Mm-hmm. And yet that's one of its great gifts. How's that change played out for you?
Well, even with food, you want to be dynamic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sitting on your haunches, just doing your thing is going to get you to place A. But if you want to be to place B or C, if you want the notoriety or the more business, you have to be dynamic. You have to do, you know, food festivals or, you know, catering, or you need to somehow expand your
farmers market.
Farmers markets. You have to expand your repertoire. And just like a musician, right? It's just a different scenery. But the same idea, right? You can, you know, a musician can totally be happy sitting in their living room and playing. And I know a lot of musicians that mm-hmm. are like, oh, I don't want to do any of that. I'm just going to sit here. My guitar makes me happy. I'm going to play. Mm-hmm. Perfect. And you're going to be at place A. Mm-hmm. You want to be at a place, you know, C or B and be an arena venue sort of play, then you have to move to the next level. So, mm-hmm. so it's the same with food, right? You participate in the things that support your food ideals. And then you find your people who are going to then support you back. You know, when you're using farmers' food, you're going to get the support from the farmers and the Absolutely. People that support that ideal. You know, even down to our drinks, it's interesting because we use locally produced drinks. So I had mentioned our coffee before. Our coffee Yep. comes directly from South America. It gets roasted in Vancouver specifically for us to Tyson's, you know, standard. And then comes right to us. So it's very, even though it is global, it's coffee has to be.
Nobody grows coffee in this
Can't
country.
Can't find it here yet.
No.
Yeah, not yet. Just wait for a few more years when it's warmer. Yeah. but all the drinks that we have in stock, we use, you know, Farm and Karma, which is from, I believe, the Lower Mainland. One interesting one that we carry is Loop Juices. And their format, they're down in the Lower Mainland, and their format is using produce that can't go to market.
Okay, sure.
So they make lovely fruit and vegetable juices using that stuff that, you know, maybe it's an apple with a spot on it, so they're not going to sell it in the grocery store, right? Yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
For sure, yes.
We use our coffee syrups are from a company, Simps, down in Kelowna. And full circle, Jerry Job is the person that operates that company. And he was the head bartender at Rod's Regional Table. So there's another instance of that, you know, that star-shaped branch out from that restaurant and the caliber of people that came from it. you know, some people often, not often, but every once in a while will come in and say, hey, can I have a Diet Coke? I'm like, no, but we have, yes. you know, here's Phillips soda, which is made here in BC. And we have these lovely juices and the Farming Karma and the Wise and all of those other sorts of things, because they support that ideal that we have as well.
Yeah. And the supply chain is not so long that if there is a bad patch of weather in yeah. some faraway place, it all disappears.
And do I really want to be supporting Diet Coke? No, I don't. I don't want to. Like, they don't need my support. And I don't want to support. I don't want to support that sort of industry, right?
Along these lines, being an owner manager of a vegan bistro seems to me to fit in, because, and we, this is something that a lot of people are concerned about, is how do you get the meat that's on the table? Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of it is from large producers who aren't particularly concerned about the health of their animals, except as they can have a lot of, you know, saleable meat, mm-hmm. rather than having high quality, very healthy animals, which are thinner and run around more and mm-hmm. and have to be, you know, cooked a little longer to tenderize the meat. And this was something that you also said was a problem for you and is for many people, and that's the way animals are raised mm-hmm. in the industrial mm-hmm. world, the CAFO world, you know, concentrated animal feed operation world.
Yeah, it's awful.
Which has been actively suppressed by industry and government. You can't take a picture of a CAFO in some states without getting arrested. You can't certainly, absolutely not take a picture inside an abattoir.
Right.
Where the essentially assembly line process is taking place. How's that been a kind of ongoing motivator for you to pursue the direction in food that you have?
Well, I mean, that's been on the forefront for quite a long time. Even when I was serving and eating meat, like at Table 24, I was using Okanagan beef. I don't think that company is around anymore, but it was down in the Okanagan, and their specialty was is they finished, instead of finishing with grain, they finished with the grapes, the grape mash and stuff,
yeah, sure.
from the winery. So they mashed. Were using, they were using that product that was normally thrown away or recycled or composted. And that's what they were finishing the beef with. And it was amazing. And you could go there and you could see the cows and you can meet them and pet them and right. all that sort of thing. Right.
This is Flossie. Yeah. This is Bonnie.
And then there's something cryptic about why can't I see where my food comes from? Mm. Why can't I go into that chicken facility, you know, what's going on in there where I can't see yes. my food?
Yes.
So it is very scary. And it is on the forefront that these animals get treated mm. poorly. And if you've ever known or been a chicken catcher, you know that, oh yeah, we break their legs all the time and it's just normal. But that's not a secret. Just standard through the industry. And you're like, really? So that sucks.
And,
sorry, I don't know if I can say that word.
That's a word with other letters would make it a little bit word. But it is something that actually our society has to come to terms with, because growing animals this way not only makes them unhealthy, but it's really hard on the environment. Mm-hmm. You have an incredible mm-hmm. waste concentration problem. Mm-hmm. Every time there's a hurricane in the eastern states, all of these big settling ponds for mm-hmm. Excrement and urine spill over onto the landscape. And I've seen pictures of photographs of forests mm-hmm. destroyed mm-hmm. by the urine and feces that has flooded the land when the wind blows the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's problems growing in that area pretty much. They're coming to the forefront of our understanding
mm-hmm.
pretty much every day. And we're starting to realize that we can do it in a different way. People can eat animals. They don't have to eat as much as they did. They can eat some, or they can eat things like cheese and yogurt and eggs, which, you know, the eggs, the chicken is still
around.
Some
of those industries are as brutal as the, you know, the actual killing, but yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it's all in the attitude we have. If we treat animals with respect, then I think we're getting into the right space. But the disrespect that's associated with industrial farming of animals is, I think, pretty manifest and becoming less satisfactory as we go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've roamed the terrain, David, and it's been an absolute delight having you here in the studio with us. The kind of work you're doing with Still Food is at the forefront of this kind of transformation of the food system that we're going through. Mm-hmm. And I think you are playing and will probably continue to play an important role in that transformation. And for that, I think it's fair to say we're all grateful. And well, I certainly am to have had you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure.